Good morning. We gather together again. I have no reason to think that these hearings will be curtailed, but I do have a plan should anything go wrong, and that is we will all convene in the State Law Library, which is on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, and it's called the Risser Justice Center. Library is on the second floor, and we can convene there. The difficulty is there's no recording, but the court apologizes that all of you have made this trek twice. So should anything go wrong, see you at the Justice Research Center 10 minutes after we evacuate. Right? That's our emergency plan. We have as our first petition 1003 in the matter of the petition to amend Supreme Court Rule 81.02. And we have as presenters Dean Strang, John Skilton, and David E. Jones. And I see Michael McCann, who was scheduled and was here the last time, is not going to be here. Mr. Skilton.
May it please the Court, John Skilton, for petitioners here. First, with respect to Mr. McCann, he was unable to make it today and sends his apologies to the Court. With the Court's permission, we'd like to move Attorney Robert Freebird up to the presenter category and count that as appropriate as part of our time. I would also, with the Court's permission, like to reserve 5 minutes at the end of the hearing in order to comment on matters that may arise during the course of the hearing. This is, of course, a petition to amend Rule 8102 in two material respects. First, to increase the rate for court-appointed attorneys generally from $70 to $80 an hour. And then secondly, to issue a benchmark of reasonableness as it relates to private attorney, public defender appointment. I do not practice in this area, but those who will address the Court will speak to the practical realities of this kind of rate. I'd only say on behalf of the petitioners generally, a group of lawyers I think known to the Court generally, that the position is that $40 an hour in particular is manifestly unreasonable, and that what we ask the Court to do here is to give guidance to the courts generally, to the legislature as a matter of the appropriate funding, and to weigh in on a matter which the Friedrich case, I think, makes clear is a shared responsibility of the Court and the legislature, and I would argue a constitutional responsibility of the Court, not only as to its powers to administer justice in this state, but as to those mandates that were constitutionally placed on the states by the Gideon case. And I believe this in the end, and hopefully the hearing will probe why a rate increase, even though modest, will help facilitate the issue of quality justice in this state. The last point I want to make in terms of my statements at this time is to say that what I think the justice system seeks, as this Court is more than well aware of, is parity of representation. We are underfunded as a justice system. All of the members of the Court are full well aware of the implications of that in terms of getting money from the legislature. But nevertheless, I would argue strongly that this is in the constitutional prerogative, in the sight of the Court. It is for the Court to begin the process to weigh in on something as fundamental to the justice system. We have other problems in the justice system. I have a son-in-law who is the assistant district attorney in Dane County. He's at that 10-year level where we find our prosecutors. are also underfunded and encouraged essentially by the economics of the situation to find other employment. That's also a matter of extreme concern to the court, needless to say. But we have to start somewhere. And here is a place which is identifiable, which can be linked to the qualitative delivery of justice, equal justice for all, in the court system of this state, and relating directly to the defense, the quality defense of indigence. So I implore the court to look seriously at this petition and to pass on it favorably.
Mr. Skilton, yes. I agree that although compensation does not always equate with good services, I mean, you know, you can buy sometimes the most expensive product, but if you check it out, it may not be any better or may even not be as good as a less expensive product. But I agree and have read Mr. Birdsall's written statement about the costs of running a law office and the effect of the $40 rate. And I agree that if you don't pay enough, the lawyer cannot put enough time in. And that probably will not be good representation, and that is a constitutional problem. And I agree that the result of ineffective assistance of counsel, and I use that word not in its constitutional sense, but more broadly, is very costly to the system because you have a lot of do-overs. And if you don't have do-overs, you'll have a lot of appeals that ask for a do-over. So I agree with that. And I agree that the court set the $70 rate a long time ago, that the court said it would look at it every 2 years, but it hasn't. So I don't have too much problem, you know, saying raise it $10, which is really very modest, as you state. My problem comes in the part of the rule that says it's unreasonable to do anything else. That's a finding at which will make the legislative rate set for the state public defender's office per se looks to me bad. And then the public defender is caught between a legislative enactment, our court rule, and the fact that it doesn't have money. I don't know how much, if the public defender appears, and I should check that, they usually are pretty late at the end of the year of paying bills because they just don't have the money. So let alone that it's a low rate, you don't get paid right away, right?
Well, Your Honor is properly raising the practical consequences of...
Constitutional question, too.
And a constitutional question, which, by the way, may trump the practical consequences. I think the court suggested as much. But there are two things that I would state. The legislature here, in fact, hasn't acted de facto. I mean, it's been silent for 15 years, so this rate has maintained its low status indefinitely.
But did act. It reduced it.
Well, okay, but wasn't that 15 years ago?
Yeah. Well, whatever the time, right. It was higher, and then it was reduced.
And the other thing I would state, and in terms of how at least I look at the rule, it's a benchmark of reasonableness of rates. It's not suggesting that those who perform services at $40 an hour have not performed proper services. But it's the court weighing in on something that is peculiarly within the knowledge of the court. What is a reasonable rate for attorneys given overhead, given the responsibility, given the circumstance? And the process has to start somewhere. Right now it's like this. the legislature pointing at the court and the court pointing at the legislature. And to use one of the court's, the chief's favorite analogy, somebody has to pick up the starfish and throw it in the sea.
Mm-hmm. You get burned when you do it.
Well, but in any event, the point is you've got to start somewhere. And I believe that it is a statement worth making by the court when it deals with its constitutional role of administering justice to indigent defendants in the state of Wisconsin, that we want parity of representation. The system requires parity. It's based on two advocates of equal skill and an impartial judge. That is the foundation of this society, ingrained in the Supreme Court's top. Equal justice under law. I don't think it can be escaped by avoiding responsibility by this court, because as the Friedrich case makes clear, at most this is a shared responsibility. But I believe that when you add the constitutional dimension of fair representation in a courtroom, it shifts the responsibility of this court to weigh in when, in fact, a rate is manifestly unreasonable and has persisted for far too long. I think it was $35 an hour when it was first brought into the statutory system in 1978. You can't conduct an appropriate defense in many cases, not all, at $40 an hour. I am a great believer in pro bono legal services, civil and criminal. But in the criminal context, the choice isn't voluntary. And I leave the court with the notion that this is qualitative justice that we're talking about. It's a means of obtaining it. It's not perfect. After all, we're not talking about $250 an hour here. We're talking bringing it up to a level that is consistent with other court appointments in the state.
Mr. Skilton, I noticed in the materials that were submitted the range of pay that is being provided in other states. When you did that look-see, who paid it? Was it the counties? Was it the state? Or did the court itself participate in the payment?
The court is, Justice Rogensack is referring to, I think it's Exhibit C, mm-hmm. In the brief, which is the Spangenberg study. And I must confess to the court, I've read even internally what our court is doing to assess who's paying what, where, and why. And it's a chore of first understanding acronyms before you even get into the substance of what we're talking about. And the answer is, I don't know. And I'm not sure the court does either. And what you really get out of this June 2007 report is the mishmash. But what you also can obtain by looking at it is $80 an hour fits somewhere in the middle of what states are paying.
The rate doesn't concern me, frankly. I think the rate is modest. What concerns me is who pays and what kind of burden are we putting on other parts of the Wisconsin state systems of governments, municipal and state, and is the court to participate itself in any way in picking up some of that tab? And I don't know if courts in other states participate or if it's always some other entity that funds it. But the funding is where you're going to get a sticker on this. I don't think anybody thinks that $80 is an outrageous rate to be paid.
Old household finance ad, where's the money coming
right,
from? I serve as one of many members on behalf of the bar on the Legislative Council Committee looking at the funding of the justice system. And
right.
I asked the chief when I was in the opposite role whether the justice system in this state was underfunded, and I'm going to paraphrase her to say yes.
Oh, I think it is, too.
And then I asked the Attorney General, who also appeared, at where the money's coming from, because he was clearly stating that the safety of the citizens of the state require that we adequately fund the prosecution role. And he said from general purpose revenues, that's where it ought to come from, he said. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't addressed in reference to this issue. Mm-hmm. But I agree with him. And so I would say to the court that we need your input here, and it is in a very tough, for everybody, economic climate. But here's where the Constitution fits in. I have no embarrassment by advocating that the court weigh in on reasonableness when you're talking about delivery of justice in our criminal justice system on something as specific as rate. If the court weighs in, then there's an arrow in the quiver, so to speak, in terms of the legislature doing its job. And so my answer to the court is we better find the money for the justice system in this state.
Mr. Skilton, one of the questions that I have relates to the tie-in to the Consumer Price Index. As far as the future, would you address that and the justification for that, please?
Only to say that we're involved in an inflationary situation. The chief alluded to the fact that these rates were to be periodically reviewed. In fact, inertia occurs. You don't get to it. And so this is a way of making adjustments as the economy would dictate, keeping at some pace with inflation. A modest proposal, frankly, if the court can come up with something better, I would be, for one, delighted with it. But the concept is that rates, it goes back to what I said, $35 an hour in 1978 isn't the same as $40 an hour in 2010. It just isn't. And yet that's what we've effectively done.
Mr. Skilton, if I may, I'm only taking this time because you've got, there's quite a batting order here of people who are more than familiar with the issue that the court will be dealing with on a variety of different levels. And so I just want to put this out there at the beginning so that as people noodle through things and make their comments that they might address some of the things. So I'm not asking the same question 10 times, right? I look at things from a practical perspective. I look at it from having been a lawyer who tried cases, and your job is a zillion times easier, better, and justice is delivered more fairly if you have competent counsel on the other side. Same holds true as a judge. You know, everything works much better when you've got good lawyers on both sides. It's almost like great theater, really, when you're sitting there watching lawyers and their case unfolds and you have competent lawyers. So it appeals to me, of course, as it does everyone sitting up here, to have the best lawyers on the cases that you can possibly afford to have, right? But then you have to consider it from the other perspective, too, and having been a presiding judge who had to figure out how you negotiate with the county to get a rate and what's going to be reasonable, and you provide a list and you have good lawyers on the list that you can choose from. You know, the competing thought from the county is, look, this should be the state's thing anyway. You're already saddling us with a lot of costs and issues and fees, and, you know, you're just increasing this, so where's it going to come from, and how are we going to do this, and why shouldn't we just cut court commissioners, because they really should be judges anyway. And, you know, I mean, there's always this give and take, and it's unrealistic to think that you're not going to have a little pushback on where the money comes from. So it's part of what Justice Rogensack raised, but, I mean, there are practical implications on how you do it. There are practical implications on how you get a good list of lawyers so that you can select good people to try cases and represent people in GAL hearings or mental health hearings or whatever there is. But in the end, if the county's paying, then you also have to provide that reason why. Because they ask, if you can get lawyers, and you have a list of lawyers who will accept $40 an hour, how is it you're saying we have to pay them this amount per hour? And then, you know, as a creative judge, you figure out a way to explain to them the importance of doing that. But there are the realities of the situation. And then, for example, in Washington County, the county paid the lawyers. So unlike other counties where the lawyer had to go collect the fee, and really, you know, when you had 10 billable hours, it turned into 6 collectible billable hours instead of 10 hours and 10 collectible hours from the county. Does your rule in any way address the collection of the fee? Because that is, at least for us, was a huge selling point to the lawyers because they knew they had a for sure check coming in at a for sure amount versus in other counties, sure, you can bill whatever, but that's never really collectible. So sort of some practical questions that I throw out there because the reality is you got to figure out a way to explain how this is going to work.
I think, Justice Ziegler, you practically predicted that others will be addressing exactly the issues you're concerned about improperly. So I would leave with one response, and that is that there's an overarching issue that cuts through the detail, as real as the detail is, and that is the constitutional necessity of providing adequate counsel to defense of a criminal charge to a person who is unable to pay. And I think it's that breaking point that I'm asking the court to take hold of it. And somebody's got to figure it out. That's a, maybe sounds naive, but I think in that sense, if I'm naive, so was the court in its constitutional dictates. And with that, I think others will address it specifically.
Thank you. I call your attention and others to the to page 8 of the Gideon Broken Promise, which is an appendix part. And on page 8, they did a study of some of the states, not Wisconsin.
Right.
And attributed, they show who pays, the state or the county. And it ranges from 0 to the state to 100% to the state and 100% to the county and, you know, 0 to the county. And, of course, it's all the taxpayers' money. Either it's going to be from predominantly sales tax, income tax, property tax. But it'll come from the same people.
Yes.
Whether it's going to be through the county level or state. And there's something else in our materials, and I'm sorry I can't put my fingers on it right this minute, which explains, I think the number was $5 million plus dollars that the county puts out every year for appointed counsel. But I'm not sure if that figure only covered guardian ad litems and other court-appointed people or also included the state public defender. But the figures are in that the state public defender is office is taking a lesser percent of cases because of its cut, if its lack of funding, and put more on the local bar, on the bar, private bar. It used to be, what, 60-40, and now it's a different percent, 50, more 50-50, or thereabouts. So as to the funding.
I, Chief, and then I'm going to leave the podium. The court's been more than generous with its time. The Sclade study. Sclade was one of the committees when I chaired the ABA consortium that reported, is a very valuable study. And if you look at page 7 of that Exhibit A to our brief, you'll see two sentences that summarize what I've been trying to say somewhat inartfully. It's under lack of adequate funding. Other legal representation cannot be rendered unless indigent defense systems are adequately funded. Attorneys who do not receive sufficient compensation have a disincentive to devote the necessary time and effort to provide meaningful representation or even participate in the system at all. I do not suggest it would not be true that the lawyers in this state who are serving clients at $40 an hour aren't doing their level best. That is not the point of this petition. And anything I say that suggests otherwise would be misinterpreted. I thank the court.
Mr. Skelton.
Yes, Justice.
If I may, could you want to amend 81 2002, what is the scope of that rule?
Well, the sub A of the rule, of course, relates to appointed counsel and a rate that applies particularly in county appointments that have been alluded to. The second part that we're asking, the 40 to 80?
No. What I'm trying to get at is clearly you're addressing the representation of criminal defendants, but what else does the rule cover?
Well, I think the Chief alluded to some other instances that would be affected, ad litems, appointments, and the like. I do not suggest that it is in a tight box with respect to criminal defense appointments, but I do think that's the one we are pointing at, and particularly as we convert it to the sub 2 or however the revisor has relabeled it as it relates to public defender statute appointments. That is specific, of course, to criminal indigent appointments.
I may have missed something, but in what I read, I don't think I understood the full scope of the rule. We are told in some of the materials that we've received that, for example, the Office of Lawyer Regulation would have increased costs. But, I mean, I think it's incumbent, if you expect the court to act, that we know exactly what it is we're acting on. And it's a little hard to talk about constitutional provisions when you might also be talking about the rates paid to OLR attorneys.
The court's point is well taken, and with the court's permission, we will supplement the showing with an effort on our part at least to define the scope of other representations that would be affected, particularly by the 70 to 80 increase. I would say in a modest response to the court that it's already at 70 with respect to this full scope of appointments. So there, with respect to that issue, you're pushing it up 10. Dollars, and though it obviously has impact, and you'll hear about that, and it is for a broader scope than just criminal representation. Nevertheless, I think it's a slightly more modest question than the 40 to 80 issue that we're dealing with, which is in the criminal context. But with the court's permission, I will attempt to supplement the record on that point.
Mr. Skilton, I was going
yet, Mr. Skilton.
That's right. I was going to save the question for another presenter, but Justice Prosser's inquiry is the preface to my question. And that is, as I read the proposed change, it involves, of course, all court-appointed attorneys. And the counties appoint guardian ad litems, and pay for guardian ad litems oftentimes. There's guardianships that are paid for by the counties. There's the constitutionally indigent that are paid for by the counties.
Criminal.
When I say constitutionally indigent, I mean in criminal cases, yes. I need to know what the fiscal impact is to the counties.
Well, you've taken me out of my ability to give a direct answer.
Yes, but yeah. I'm hoping someone can tell us, because there's part of me that says, absolutely. I mean, isn't to stand here and say $40 an hour is adequate, in my mind, is an outrageous statement, just outrageous.
Well,
and yet beyond that, it gets much more complicated, and one of the complications is, what's the fiscal impact of 70 to 80 to the counties?
Well,
Mr. Skilton?
Yes.
Mark Wadium, lobbyist for Outagamie County, will be appearing. I guess he's going to say that Outagamie County wants to spend more money. Carlo Escueda, clerk of the Circuit Court, Dane County, my guess is he will say the same thing. John Barrett, clerk of the Circuit Court, Milwaukee County, probably will say the same thing, and we'll ask that the court rip up their statements that have been filed in protest to this. Do you think that we're right? I'm right?
I'm sorry, Chief.
Do you think I'm right? That's what they're going
to
say?
My guess is we'll hear direct answers to Justice Bradley's questions, but There's an element here, and again, it sounds naive, but having worked the civil side of indigent problems for about 20 years, there is an element of if you build it, they will come. If you take the risk, you'll get it done. We've done that. This court has done it in situations, for example, when I was arguing the petition, that lawyers were saying they'd never pay $50 an hour in order, or $50 a year in order to get it done, and they did. And actually, it's worked pretty well because the court took some initiative. I think Justice Prosser asked me at the time, take it to the legislature. But the legislature didn't act. So the lawyers did something about it. And the point of the matter is because the court took the initiative. So I'm challenging the court in a very hard economic environment, realizing the tough political issues that get subsumed and brought into the discussion. Nevertheless, I style this particularly with the caveat that Justice Prosser expressed, particularly as it relates to 40 to 80 in the public defender context, private appointments as a constitutional issue for the court.
Thank you.
And only the court.
Thank you, Mr. Skilton. Is Mr. Strang next? Mr. Strang? Dean Strang?
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the entire court. I thought that I would start this morning by returning to Justice Prosser's question, and then I'd like to speak a little bit more broadly on the topic that Justice Rogensack raised. With respect to the range of lawyers covered by 81.02, I think it bears note that we have not proposed changing the existing language in that first sentence.
You're not changing the scope.
No. So you have, I assume, a knowable scope of what lawyers today fall within that rule, what types of appointments. I don't know those numbers, but I assume that they are available to the court, and we've not proposed any change in that scope. There is no question that among the petitioners, our primary range of focus went from probably guardians ad litem to special prosecutors appointed at county expense, and as I understand it, when the Attorney General is appointed special prosecutor, that's a DOA expense. When Dean Strang is appointed as a special prosecutor, that's county expense. And then finally, the so-called dean appointments, State v. Dean, the constitutionally indigent, as Justice Bradley described them. But there's also no question that on rare occasions, counsel will have to be appointed to represent a member of the bench in a given county. There's no question that OLR lawyers, for example, probably fall within the scope of this rule. We don't intend to change any of that by the petition. And I think the second point that I'd like to make immediately, just about the structure of our petition, in terms of quantifying the fiscal impact on counties, is that you not overlook proposed subsection 1M. Now, that's not just a nod to Article 1, Section 10 of the U.S. Constitution and the, you know, non-impairment of contracts. It is a nod to the reality that counties or this court may wish for certain classes of appointments to go out and contract with providers. There may be reasons, if I know that I'm going to be a frequent guardian ad litem and I can spread the COE costs and just the general costs of acquiring competency in that area across a predictable stream of appointments, there may be reasons, good reasons, for me to contract at a rate lower than the you know, the, what is otherwise the floor of minimum reasonableness. And everybody may win in that. My enhanced competency as I focus on guardian ad litem work or whatever it may be redounds to the benefit of children for whom I advocate, and the lower cost I'm able to offer redounds to the benefit of the county and the property tax payers in our state.
Mr. Strang, 1M is now the rule. You're just not touching
it. Right. We aren't touching it, and we left it, you know, by design. We talked about it. The petitioners and especially counsel talked about that. If we're proposing sub 3, why should we leave 1M? Well, because there are reasons, whether it's, you know, the Legal Aid Society, whether it's someone who wants to do a GAL practice or what have you. There are good reasons beyond the concern about impairing contracts.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
My guess would be sub 3 is a sticker.
Well, that's my guess, too.
Okay. And sub 3 says the payment of an hourly rate less than the rate set forth in 81021 for legal services rendered pursuant to appointment by the state public defender is unreasonable. Now, that is declaring a statute and administrative rules per se unreasonable. And I'm trying to play it out in my mind. So you are appointed by the public defender, your private bar, you get $40 an hour. They pay you $40 an hour. And you go to the court and say, no, Supreme Court Rule 81023 says that is unreasonable. Unreasonable means, in legalese, unconstitutional.
No.
Okay.
I think not.
All right. And what do you think it means? And what does it do when you go to the county and say, or the state, because if the state public defender is doing it, it's going to come out of state money. Go and say, I want more, and you come on up here and say, hey, court, you said it was unreasonable. They're paying me an unreasonable rate. The general rule in law is you pay reasonable rates.
That is the general rule in law, and we use the term unreasonable intending explicitly to invoke one of the core competencies of the judicial branch, which is to decide reasonableness of attorney's fees.
What's the legal effect of 3?
It is not to make inoperative anything in Chapter 977 or anything in Chapter PD of the Wisconsin Administrative Code. It is not to predetermine the unconstitutionality of anything in either statute or administrative code. It is entirely uncoded language.
It's what uncoded.
It is not coded. We are not speaking as semioticians here. We are saying, we are asking and recognizing that it's an act of honesty and courage that we implore, but we're asking the court to say publicly what all of us know, which is that in 2010, the rate paid under Chapter 977 by the legislature is unreasonable.
Counselor, isn't that sort of an advisory opinion?
No.
Why not?
Because, again, assessing reasonableness of attorney's fees is something within the core competency of the judicial branch. And this rule, by this rule, the court will be, I think, making very clear that parties may contract around that. And there's nothing in sub 3 that says we are invoking a rulemaking power to invalidate Chapter 977 in any part or any part of the Wisconsin Administrative Code.
Well why?
We are saying, sir, that the rate is unreasonable.
What if you had a long whereas clause in the order,
mm-hmm.
assuming this, and you could set forth constitutional requirement of counsel, the practical effect that it's through adversary counsel and our adversary system that you hope to reach the truth, that you can use some figures of what the costs of running a law office are and what the reasonableness of the statutory fixed fee of $40, that in 1960s, when I began the practice of law, the state bar's hourly fee was $18. Now it's 40. Let's see, that's 50 years later. I mean, by definition, that's unreasonable. Although price does not equate to value, that use the language that Mr. Skilton quoted from that study, that the court has through the budget system, asked for increased in indigent standards, and I think in the last 2-3 maybe, asked for increased compensation for lawyers, both at the defense and the prosecutor end, to reach Mr. Skilton's point. And therefore adopts this for its own court-appointed and urges the legislature to revise its statutes appropriately. I mean, if that's what three is, you know, you could even say in a whereas clause, appears unreasonable, or it is unreasonable in light of all of the above, and therefore we adopt, assuming the court's willing to do that. What I'm trying to say, ask you really, is what does three mean? And when you put it in a rule this way and you don't have any explanation, you got a problem, put it in a whereas clause, it's the basis for other things.
The court, Your Honor, is proposing, I think, precisely what we intend to propose, putting your finger unknowingly on a conversational problem I've had all my life, which is opening conversations entirely too tersely. And what we're looking for the court to do is open a conversation with the legislature specifically and the broader public in subsection 3. That's a more eloquent and nuanced way to open the conversation. But whatever the words are, I think we've taken a prudential approach here in simply asking the court to say that which is undeniably so as a starting point, not to try to use powers under 751.12 at this point or some other rulemaking power, not to invalidate a statute. That would be an advisory opinion. There's no present case or controversy in the sense that would justify striking down a statute. But compensation of lawyers, any lawyer, special prosecutor, GAL, dean appointment, whatever, anyone who practices there in front of a circuit court judge, who's part of the administering of justice case by case, any lawyer's compensation is a concern of the judiciary, and at a minimum falls within a power that the judiciary at a minimum shares with the legislature. So you are an appropriate speaker. How you phrase your appeal to the legislature, that's why you're there and I'm here. This is just a petition and a proposal to open the discussion.
So my inarticulate and not complete whereases might suffice instead of three. Might suffice instead of sub three.
I'd like to see the court reach a conclusion with that usually follows a whereas clause, I mean, in terms of proclamation drafting, there may need to be provisos as well as whereases. But, it's a petition and a proposal. It's a starting point of conversation with the court in the hope of spurring a broader conversation with the legislature.
You know, in 81.01, that's a very interesting section.
I'm sure.
It says that notwithstanding any statute that fixes a fee or compensation.
Yes.
If a court, which includes Circuit Court, Court of Appeals, this court, if a court appoints a lawyer to do designated duties, the court can either provide for the statutorily fixed fee or its own reasonable fee. And that's what the Friedrich case was all about.
Yes.
Said that was an okay rule,
yes,
even though it said, hey, we're not going to pay attention to some statutes. I don't know what has happened, out in Wisconsin land as to whether the courts are using the fixed statutory fee, whatever that may be in the case. But if you were going to draft a rule that said ignore the statutory fixed state public defender fee, you'd have to draft it something like 81.01, but you didn't.
And we don't intend, and I'm not sure that I'd have a concern about whether the court really could do that in that
That's
context.
That's why I'm pushing on 3, because
right,
I have that concern. So that's why I want to know what you want when you do 3, because it raises that concern. Therefore, if we know what you want and if we agree with it, we can draft something.
But
if.
Here's where I'm pausing on that, Your Honor. Lawyers assigned by the state public defender are not court-appointed.
That's right.
Counsel.
That's why 81.02 does not cover them.
Correct.
And that's why your new subsection 3 does cover them.
Yes. In terms of reasonableness. Now, I want to go back to Justice Rogenczyk's question of John. She, rightly points to a variety of experience in the states. And, while we're being honest, let's acknowledge that in 1963, the United States Supreme Court handed down an unfunded mandate. They called it Gideon against Wainwright. The states, since then, some of them already were ahead of Gideon in forming responses to provide counsel to the indigents, but the states since Gideon certainly have done what American states do in our federalist system, which is respond in different ways, try to meet the challenge in ways that locally make the most sense. So you've got one way to look at it would be a hodgepodge. I can't name many states, but there are some like Oklahoma where indigent defense is just a county obligation. There are other states that have county-funded public defenders in large counties, but a state system that covers more rural or less populous counties. There is just a whole range of responses to which John rightly adverted in the Gideon report, the Gideon's Promise Unbroken report. You can call that a hodgepodge. Another way to describe that is there are a whole bunch of laboratories out there. There are different responses to meeting the challenge of indigent representation in different places. I don't know there's anything wrong with that. I can't speak to most of the states, but I can speak to one possibility that Justice Rogenczyk raised, which is, are there places where this actually comes out of the court's budget? Is it a line item in the court? don't know, others behind me may, whether there are any states or counties within states that operate that way. I do know that in the federal system, indigent defense is a line item in the judiciary budget.
Right.
This falls under the budget of the Administrative Office of U.S. Courts.
Well, Bob Friedrich was maybe the first state public defender. And at that time, but he'll be able to tell us, my recollection is that it was part of the judiciary, and or before that it may have been part of the judiciary, but that the judiciary did not think that it should be part of it because it's an adversary council, and ultimately the office was made part of the executive branch, not that.
Right.
Mr. Friedrich may have a better recollection than I do, and I think the year was 1974, if I'm right. And he is scheduled to speak next.
Yeah, he is, indeed.
Counselor, this is what you were talking about, the line item in the federal judiciary budget. Do you know how long that has been in that form for the federal budget for appointed counsel?
I believe since 1964, but I can't assert it as a verity.
Thank you very much.
And the issues of independence of the defense function are something that the feds wrestle with a good deal.
That's right. And we did, too. When I say we, I was a member of the bar at the time. The court wrestled with it, and sometime that was resolved. But someone here should be able to give us exactly the sequence of events.
Exactly. And I can't. But although I consider myself substantially younger than Mr. Friedrich, I was the state's first federal public defender. And I can
tell
you. That
was in the Eastern District?
Initially in the Eastern District and then in the Western District as well in 2004.
So public defender's office has changed over the years. I mean, the concept of it and how far it's developed and who gets permanent.
In the federal system?
Yes.
The structure hasn't changed since 1964. The implementation has, because the Criminal Justice Act leaves it to the district judges in every district to decide how to deliver defense services to indigents. The time came where the district judges in the Eastern District finally decided that they wanted a public defender organization. And then they had a menu. They could pick an actual federal agency, or they could pick a nonprofit that's
local choice.
Exactly, local choice. And then the Western District asked to sign on with the Eastern District. But I think what matters about this in terms of the problem we present the court today is that there really isn't any mystique in the end, at least to doing criminal cases in the federal system. At least on the defense side, it's the same pool of the indigent. You're undertaking the same tasks on their behalf. The garbage cans in the courtroom may get emptied more regularly, and you know there's certainly a lower volume. There are fewer cases in the federal system, but you're doing fundamentally the same work on behalf of fundamentally, you know, a cross-section or a slice of the same pool of people. What's different is that right now, the defender of the indigent in federal court is paid at $125 an hour. That's to go to $141 an hour as of January 1. It won't happen because there'll be a continuing resolution in Congress and it'll take some time to fund that. But it will happen, I predict, in 2011. And so when I came in as the federal defender and the court said, all right, we're going to hand over the process of appointing counsel for the indigent from the clerk of court to the federal defender's office, I inherited a list from the clerk of court, from Safran Nadolsky, of probably, I don't remember exactly now, but probably 150 to 200 names of lawyers who had signed up to take federal court appointments. And setting aside those lawyers on the list who were not any longer available for one reason or another, what I did was ask everyone to reapply if they were still interested in taking federal appointments, and told them, look, you're going to have some competency requirements in terms of CLE training and participation in seminars that the office will offer and whatnot, but we're also going to try to get you more appointments, more than one or two a year. We'll try to get you in here regularly so you know what the judges are doing and what the U.S. Attorney's Office is doing and that you feel comfortable. So people reapplied, and almost everyone did, because the rate of compensation was attractive. And I lost friends, or at least friendly acquaintances, when I cut that panel by somewhere between 60 and 75%, when I eliminated about two-thirds of the people who had been taking federal appointments.
On competency grounds?
On competency grounds, by my subjective, arrogant way of looking at things. I had to sell it to the district judges, but they didn't give me much pushback on that. But on competency grounds, yes, to be blunt about it. And at least the general assessment at the time was that the quality of representation rose. If you talked to assistant U.S. attorneys, if you talked to magistrate judges, if you talked to members of the private bar, the assessment at the time was that there was some rise in the quality of representation that the poor were receiving in federal court. That's impossible to quantify. I can't do it, and that's always the problem with trying to justify, you know, increased pay or resources for lawyers on either side of the system. It's very hard to quantify what are essentially qualitative differences. But I'm convinced, because I was in those courts every day, I'm convinced that we saw it. And, you know,
what percent was handled by the private bar and what percent by your employees?
Initially, that changed over time because employees, initially, it was just me. I had to find a chair and then a desk and whatnot. But, but that changed. And I think our first year, the private bar handled still more than 50% of the indigent appointments that came through. And you know, bear in mind that just like in state court, in federal court, better than 90% of the people indicted can't afford to hire a lawyer. And then I think by the time I left in 2005, the Federal Defender Office was probably handling 60-65%, something like that, of the appointments in the Eastern District. It was a little bit different in the Western District by intention of at least one of the judges then sitting. But in the Eastern District, it was probably
two. Which way is it in the Western District?
In the Western District, at least initially, they wanted to tilt more toward the private bar, much as was the state experience back in the 70s when the state public defender was created. There were, county by county, there were set-asides for the private bar. But that's how it worked. And I mean no disrespect to anyone who was on that larger list that I inherited. I mean no disrespect to them at all. But when the smaller federal list then was in place, the other folks remained on the state public defender assigned counsel list in the main. It's just a glimpse at one system. I wish I could speak intelligently about Ohio or Georgia or, you know.
No, but that's your comments states, are very helpful to me.
But that's how it was. And I think if there are no further questions, I'd like to turn it over to David Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Strang. Freeberg?
David has deferred. Good morning.
Morning.
My name is Robert Freeberg, and I am one of the petitioners, and General Skilton made a field promotion today from an appearance to a presenter, so I'm now here as a presenter instead of a client. I was the first state public defender appointed by this court, by the Supreme Court of the state of Wisconsin.
I told you to take the job.
And as such, I was an employee of sorts of this court. The public defender's office was funded by a Ford Foundation grant with matching state funds. Shortly after the Gideon decision, I'm going to give some historical perspective and then
tell
some
me
thoughts.
What year that was before
1966.
You 66. Thank you
right.
very much.
Just about a month before the Miranda decision. Since I recall that, I became swamped with Miranda petitions from inmates. And it was just appellate jurisdiction only for the state public defender. Shortly after the Gideon decision, the Ford Foundation created the National Defender Project with a $4 million grant to the National Legal Aid and Defender Association. At the time, General Charles L. Decker was the Judge Advocate General of the Army. Prior to becoming the Judge Advocate General, General Decker was the founder of the Judge Advocate General's School and became its first commandant. General Decker was persuaded to retire from the Army to become the director of the Ford Foundation Defender Project. And as the state public defender of the Ford Foundation grant, I had the pleasure of working closely with General Decker since the Wisconsin program was one of about 20 or 25 experimental programs created with the Ford Foundation grant. I mention this because General Decker retired as the Judge Advocate General of the Army to direct the federal project, the Defender Project, because he deeply believed that the quality of our justice system was directly dependent upon providing defendants with counsel that were at least as competent as the prosecution. That is why General Decker spent so much of his career in the military training military lawyers to be both prosecutors and defense attorneys at the JAG School, which he founded. General Decker often stated in no uncertain terms that in our meetings that we had with him, that in our adversarial system of justice, as opposed to an inquisitional system, truth emerges when evidence is confronted and controverted. In other words, and I'm sure we all agree, our system cannot work unless the defendant is provided competent counsel whose only concern is representing the defendant. Competent defense counsel is an absolute necessity to prevent miscarriages of justice. As far back as the 1960s, the Model Defender Act recommended that appointed counsel should be provided with a reasonable rate of compensation. Unfortunately, Wisconsin does not provide a reasonable compensation for defense counsel, and that's why the court should now establish a minimum hourly rate. I reviewed the financial statements of my law firm. The hourly cost for general overhead, occupancy, staff salaries, staff benefits, not including lawyers, is about $90 an hour per attorney. When non-equity attorney salaries and benefits are added in, the hourly cost is around $200 an hour per attorney. In other words, since I am an equity attorney, I don't make any income unless every lawyer in my office bills and collects over $200 an hour, which has made a second appearance here extremely costly to my firm. And I don't know
May the record reflect.
Yes. And I don't know who to sue.
We'll tell you later, Mr. Graber.
It's called immunity. Starts with an I.
I think it's the person who made the call. This is the economic reality of the practice of law today. The current hourly rate for appointed counsel is not reasonable. And as all the speakers have said, it is difficult to quantify. It is not hard to assume that the quality of the defense suffers as a direct result of failing to provide a reasonable rate of compensation. My own direct experience is anecdotal. I am involved in a federal collateral challenge to a state court homicide conviction where the defendant was represented by appointed counsel. appointed by the public defender. The obvious defense was lack of mental competence. The court-appointed counsel, in my opinion, failed to provide a proper defense by failing to dig deep into the mental history of his client, something that is basic, and in failing to properly communicate with his client, which is also basic. Maybe more compensation would have made a difference. There is no way to know for certain. But one thing is certain to me, and that is the more time a lawyer devotes to these cases, the more money he or she loses. Stating that an hourly rate of less than $80 per hour is unreasonable is an extraordinarily modest request. $80 an hour will cover more, but not all of the overhead. Because $80 an hour will probably still fail to cover all of the overhead, lawyers will still be continuing to contribute their time and talent to the community without pay by providing these critical services. More importantly, I believe approving this petition will result in a better system of justice, and strongly urge that the petition be approved. Thank you.
Counselor, have you or anybody involved with this side of the project surveyed the counties in Wisconsin to determine today how much money each county puts forth for a Supreme Court Rule 8102 payment?
I haven't. As I said at the beginning, I received a field promotion today, and okay. I was just here as a presenter, so I cannot answer that question.
Do you know if anybody here knows? What kind of dollars are we talking about?
Why don't we wait until one of the county representatives comes in, and there is material of a total amount, and then what Milwaukee County has done, at least Mr. Barrett has done that. And if Ms. Rich would get a copy of the PPAC's study on court funding, and it may be available downstairs. John Velker may have a hard copy of it. If not, I'm sure someone will print it out and ask Ms. Nelson to print it out. That may have some figures as of the date of that study, which was mid-2000s, and give you some of that county, state information.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Freeberg.
Question, and so does Justice Prosser. Justice Prosser.
Okay.
When you went to be public defender, and it was partially state funded, but it was you were appointed by the court.
Correct.
And that raised issues about independence.
Correct.
But at some time it was changed. You remember the history of that?
No, I don't.
Okay, thank you.
It was after
that.
I left.
Okay.
And as the court called,
I
was an office of one.
I know. I remember that. But it was the
My
first
charge
one.
Was every appeal.
Right.
And every post-conviction motion everywhere around the state. I met a lot of judges.
I know. I said 1974, but it was really, from my recollection, 64. Your recollection is 66?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Justice Prosser.
Mr. Freeberg, I'd like to get your take on subsection 3 of the proposed rule. And let me preface it this way. Listening to Mr. Skilton, there seem to be allusions that this is, that the changes are a constitutional necessity.
Yes.
And I won't comment on that. Listening to Mr. Strang, I understand Rule 3 is a statement of position that doesn't actually accomplish anything. I'm having trouble reconciling these two views, but I'd really appreciate your take on it.
I believe, probably a third take, which is what the court needs,
that the core responsibility, a core responsibility of the judicial system is to ensure that criminal defendants are adequately represented. And therefore, this court has an affirmative constitutional obligation to ensure the right of counsel. Part of that mix is compensation. Is the compensation adequate to provide proper representation? So at some level, it is fulfilling a constitutional mandate. However, I'm not sure that I agree that the court can just mandate $80 an hour and make that legislative. The court, though, it just seems to me, as a coordinate equal branch of the government, has a unique responsibility to determine adequacy of counsel, and that trumps, in a sense, what the legislature can or ought to do. That's a responsibility of the court. But at the end of the day, it's the legislature that funds it, and so it has to be a cooperative process. I think that the court making a solid statement in the area would be respected by the legislative branch. I would hope that it would be. I doubt that the court would want to use its powers, as I was sitting there and I haven't heard it, as just implementing it pursuant to its some sufficient prerogatives, although it does have some sufficient prerogatives. So at some level, and as I recall the historical, I haven't looked at this law in a long time, but I remember some famous cases like In Re Janitor, where this court invoked its some sufficient processes and powers in order to protect the institution of the judiciary. So it has some sufficient. The legislature can't encroach enough to destroy the judicial branch, and that's why this court has the power to provide appropriate funds. So in that context, since the court has to, as part of its prerogative to make sure that justice is properly administered, I think I am not recommending that it go to its some sufficient prerogatives, because I think that would be an undue clash with the legislature. However, it's behind it is if the court says that this is necessary for the proper administration of a criminal justice system, it can invoke it and ask for the legislature's cooperation and dangle out there the potential of exercising its some sufficient prerogatives and create an unfortunate, in my view, clash with the co-equal branch of government. It's long-winded, but this court does have inherent power under the Constitution to make sure that the judiciary is protected from improper encroachments by either the executive or the legislative branches.
Thank you, Mr. Friebert.
May it please the court. My name is David Jones. I will be the final speaker before Mr. Skilton provides any rebuttal. And I want to follow up. My task was to address authority questions that the court might have about its ability to promulgate the petition that we've put forward. I know that the speakers have already addressed some of those authority issues, but I want to just go and finish up what Mr. Friebert was saying to Justice Prosser, and that's that Mr. Friebert is exactly right in that the Frederick case from this court provides a really nice historical perspective and explanation as to why this court does have the authority, the inherent authority, as part of its responsibility to administer justice in this state, to set compensation. That it's an authority that is shared with the legislature. And Frederick specifically talks about this notion of a shared power, that it, although it's the exclusive province of the court to say what's appropriate compensation, The Frederick Court also recognized that there is an absolutely valid and important role from the legislature, because that body is the guardian of the public fisc. So the Frederick Court envisions a system of shared power. But what we've had in Wisconsin since 1995 is a silent partnership on the part of the courts. That we've got a legislative pronouncement of what is an appropriate or reasonable fee of $40 an hour, step back in 1995, and for 15 years, this court has not had an opportunity, or has not taken itself an opportunity, to say what it views. And what it views as a reasonable fee is uniquely within the authority and power and expertise of this court. What the petition asks the court to do is to do what courts do all the time, and that's to say what reasonable fees are. U.S. judges know this, that courts in this state every day have to deal with fee-shifting petitions or requests for reasonable attorney fees. So we know, the court knows through hard experience, what constitutes a reasonable fee. You have unique expertise in this area. You also, as the court, with the sole responsibility of ensuring the administration of justice in this state, you have an interest that's distinct from the legislature, but it's an interest that's vital to the functioning of justice in this state, and that this court has a duty to give voice to, and that's the interest of ensuring fair administration of justice. So what I thought was striking was, as we've talked about the 80, pre-gaming, you know, what do we think the justices will have trouble with? Clearly, I haven't seen one sort of furrowed brow about the notion that $80 is a fair amount of money per hour. And I haven't heard one embrace of the notion that $40 an hour is appropriate. And in fact, as Mr. Freebird explained, it's confiscatory. You can't even, if that's your pay, you can't afford to run an office. So if it is the view of this court that $80 is reasonable, and if it is the view of this court that $40 is not reasonable, then Frederick suggests that as a shared responsibility in establishing appropriate compensation, the court has a responsibility to make that view known, to not keep it to itself, to not make it a topic of conversation of chambers, but to tell the legislature, this is what we view as reasonable. This is within our wheelhouse of expertise, and this is what we say and why.
Counsel, I agree with you on several points. One, 80 is probably reasonable. I pay more than $80 an hour to my furnace man, whether he fixes my furnace or not, to the plumber, whether fixes the leak or not, and to the electrician, whether or not the repair to this faulty system works or not. And I think most homeowners who cannot perform those functions themselves, as obviously the Abrahamson family cannot, and I hope my husband doesn't hear me say that, these are not unreasonable numbers. The issue will come up as soon as we get down the list to people from the counties that this will include increasing an already heavy county burden when there's limited ability to increase taxes. And there are other burdens on the county. So it's, to me, and I'm not speaking to the court, obviously, it's a fiscal issue in terms of the counties, at least initially. And it doesn't change the scope. It's exactly the same wording, except for the last sentence where you do the consumer price index. I'm not sure whether that doesn't mean next year it goes up to 115 or some other number. So that has some concerns. So sub 3 is what bothers me. And I want to know what sub 3 means to you. Is this just a nice statement that is an important statement by the court, but of a little effect for enforcement? I mean, the kind of question I asked Dean Strang.
And I think Mr. Strang's answer was exactly right. Let me be very clear about it. The petitioners were very mindful of Frederick in crafting the proposal for the court. And we certainly have heard some suggestions of how it could be better and welcome those suggestions. But what we did not want the court to be in a position of doing was having to strike down a legislative enactment. That's a bludgeon approach to the issue that we are not at this point seeking. What we understand Frederick to say, though, that if it is a shared responsibility to set just compensation, there must be some mechanism for the court to say what it views reasonable compensation to be. So this is intended to be a statement of position. A statement of position. It will not, on the day of promulgation, the following day, the state public defender can go out and pay an appointed counsel $40 an hour. This enactment or this promulgated rule will not affect the authority of this public defender to do that, nor will it make an obligation to do that.
Does it require the court before whom the attorney is appearing, whether it be this court or the appellate court or the trial court, does it require us, if there's an objection to, as we do under 81.01, make a decision what's reasonable?
No, well, because as the statute and the PD regulations are currently configured, it's a matter between the state PD's office.
It's a contract.
Exactly
right. You
take
the deal, it's done.
Precisely right.
Right?
Precisely
right. And that falls under 1M in effect.
That's it exactly, Your Honor. And so let me just address the money issue and then come back to a notion that I want to provide a perspective from a prosecutor's standpoint on this issue. And I'll be very brief. The cost issue is actually is rather complicated. And I know the counties are concerned, and rightfully so. They have constituency that they have a responsibility to be concerned about as far as spending their money. But if the conversation that we're suggesting take place through this rule is successful, and if the legislature does do what we view the right thing and raise that minimum from $40 to $80 for public defender appointed counsel, here's what happens to the counties. You get more, you get better qualified folks who will actually respond to requests from the public defender office to provide representation. So the counties don't have to invoke, the courts don't have to invoke the 81.01 or 02 authority to provide indigent counsel. So in fact, what you do is if the legislature takes the burden and provides the funding at 80, then the counties will have a lesser responsibility to fill that gap that's now created, because when you're only able to offer 40, you're going to not have a lot of folks who are going to step up to the plate to do that, and then the burden falls on the county.
Well, it's even more than that. It's if the public defender's office can truly represent the indigent people that appear in court instead of – it's ridiculous what the standard is. I can't remember what it was, but it was like if you earn more than $400 a month, you didn't qualify for a public defender. I mean, you had to be more than poor, more than indigent to qualify for a public defender. I mean, I would think the counties like sub 3 because that reduces the burden of court-appointed attorneys. It's not like the public defender necessarily comes to court and says appoint a lawyer.
Right.
They still have their list of lawyers that accept appointments, or they take them, or they have to deal with that. But the shifting then would occur because less county appointments would occur at county expense. That's really, I think, your point.
To the point. That's exactly right. And through your experience, you know that. And let me just refer one last thing to a couple of members of the bench here in experience. This is not simply a defense counsel issue, and it's not simply a judge issue. Let me talk to you about the perspective of a prosecutor for just 1 minute. From my perspective, it's the heaviest burden and responsibility in our system. You make the charging decision, and then you bring the case, and you're representing the state with all its awful authority to deprive a person of its liberty. There's no worse feeling in the world than to look on the other side and see that the defendant that you have charged to do a grand jury is represented by someone who's not up to snuff. There is no worse feeling. Because then you have to add to your own burdens of providing a strong case, prosecution, the burden of also watching out to make sure the defense counsel doesn't make lapses and doesn't make mistakes that are going to lead us right back to here again. And you also, if you've been doing it for a while, you get a little bit of humility. And you know that you're not always right. And you know that the system was designed for a reason, that the adversarial system was designed for a reason to provide a check. And you vitally need that competent defense counsel to provide that check. So this is as important from a prosecutor's perspective as it is from anybody else. And those folks up on the bench who've done what I did, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
I just want to make clear, and I'll probably ask this of everybody if I can remember. If some three were approved and put into an order, no one who represented an indigent defendant appointed by the state public defender would be entitled to any more money than that which the state legislature provided.
That's exactly
period.
Right. Period.
So this is just what I would call a whereas clause. Saying something and urging the legislature to do something, because this will not change what the state has to pay and will not increase what the county has to pay as to appointees of the state public defender system.
Precisely right. It's an important statement. It's an important statement. It's an important part of your role, but it will not add a dime of fiscal impact to anybody.
And it, you don't find it sufficient that it's been done numerous other times yet. We want it in an official court document. I mean, that's what I hear.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right. That matters.
I understand that.
Following up on the Chief's question, I have a hesitation of putting it in a Supreme Court rule, in part because that's not the kind of substance that normally goes into a Supreme Court rule. When the Chief was earlier asking about putting it, in essence, in a whereas clause as opposed to a Supreme Court rule, I thought there was a nuanced response. Let me ask you, nuanced but excellent, by the way. let me ask you, is putting the essence of sub 3 in a whereas clause sufficient in your opinion? That is, a whereas clause in lieu of a rule, or do you see that it has to remain a Supreme Court rule?
In my view, and Mr. Skilton will correct me if my view is not the view of the petitioners, but in my view that a rule is an appropriate and the message and the medium count here. A Supreme Court rule is informed by comment from the public. And a Supreme Court rule is an opportunity where the court sits as a body and collectively gives its view on an issue. So it seems to me it's particularly important. And on an issue that it really doesn't have an opportunity to do, perhaps in a case-by-case controversy way. As Justice Roggensad pointed out, there is an aspect of advisory to this. There's no question about it. But that's okay, because that's what the court is supposed to do, can do, and is supposed to do in its rulemaking function.
I suppose it puts it in a comment instead. I can't think of a rule where we did advisory matters in the rule. We usually do that in a comment and say, hey,
although
this
counsel
rule is designed to, it has an effect of, I mean, that's usually commentary. You should object to the whereas clause because the whereas clauses generally don't get published, but a comment does.
Although, you know, this makes me think of our court building project when we went through trying to figure out how we were going to find the money to build the new courthouse. And when we did that, we looked to Chapter 70 and 70.38 and some of the suggestions, if you will, that were in the court facility section for security, for what room should be there, for what jury room should be. And it was kind of a wish list that the court put together in Chapter 70 of what a courthouse should be like in a perfect world. And so when you try to build a project, you should try to build it with those things in mind. And when you have security, you should have those kinds of security measures. And it's kind of interesting when I look at the language. It says the rules promulgated by the Supreme Court to promote communication among circuit courts, county officials, court planners, architects, contractors, blah, blah, blah. It recognizes the constitutionally appropriate participation of the circuit courts in addressing their facilities needs and priorities. And, you know, I'm thinking of that kind of language that is in an existing rule, and wondered if any of you
looked at that section at all when you were taking a look at this issue?
I would love to have said, yes, that's exactly what we were thinking about, and that's exactly right. I did not. I appreciate the court bringing that to my attention. But that's an outstanding example, clearly, of this court acting in a you should capacity. And so I don't, it's not advisory. It's a declaration of what this court views to be unreasonable. So it's not saying we maybe think. It's a clear statement, and if you do it in a rulemaking, it has a force and an effect that's appropriate when we're talking about a shared constitutional responsibility to set compensation. So if the court is comfortable about talking about the things that should go in a courthouse, and it should, then it should be equally comfortable in the same medium of a Supreme Court rule of saying what it believes to be unreasonable. Again, if the court does view $40 an hour as unreasonable, the court has a responsibility to say something. And rulemaking is an appropriate way for the court to articulate exactly what it feels.
You know what my problem is? As you all explain it, I don't have any problem with three. But I didn't read three that way. And every time somebody comes across three, whether it's a trial court judge, whether it's a court of appeals judge, whether it's a legislator, whether it's an attorney, they're not going to read it that way. They are going to read it as having some effect. This one says, is unreasonable. If we are advisory, as we were in setting forth as PPAC presented it, I think they presented it as shall, and we changed it to should as to the standards. It should say appears to be, or might be, or should be considered, not is unreasonable. There's something the matter with the way I'm trying to find a way of drafting this that does what you want, not the way I read it and said, oh dear, they're challenging the statutes, they're declaring it unconstitutional, they have a confrontational provision with the legislature when that may or may not be necessary yet or ever. So I'm saying to you, look at it again when you're sitting down, because three does not say what you or others have said they want it to say. They don't say it to a cold reader.
We will take, obviously, the court's guidance to heart on
just my right position.
I will say, before I sit down, I know Mr. Skilton is eager for me to be quiet, but I do think there is value in imperative language, in words like is or shall, but I do also understand the notion that some better crafting to state clearly the intent of the provision,
yes,
may well be appropriate.
Right,
I
because
agree
you don't intend this to void the state public defender, because it conflicts with 1M, right? If the public defender hires you, isn't it a contract?
1M is designed to specifically preserve that right.
Right.
But it's a
now, it may not fit totally because I think when we were thinking about it, it does. It's very broadly stated. Any provider of legal services,
right,
a contract.
So you can get out of that.
They do it.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
I'm sorry,
thank
Justice
you.
Prosser, I think,
mm-hmm,
has a question.
What fiscal effect, if any, will this proposed rule have on the state budget?
The same. Again, if we're talking about sub three, Your Honor, none at this point. It would only take effect if the legislature were to take the step itself.
How about sub one?
Sub one on the states, I don't believe. I'm not an expert in this area, but I believe that will be primarily borne by counties.
No, it isn't, because, for example, and this may be a small amount, but it is there, the court appoints counsel, this court.
Right, not true.
Appoints counsel on occasion when judges or courts are sued, for example.
Right.
and there was no one else to represent, be the adversary. So that's going to come out of the state budget. It will come out of, in fact, I am fairly confident, it will either come out of the director of state courts budget, because we've been watching that, because it is not a sum sufficient, but we watch it anyway, or it might come out, if it deals with the circuit court, it might come out of the circuit court budget, but I think it comes out of the director's budget. So that's a state budget.
And the Chief Justice's clarification reminds me that if I don't know what I'm talking about, I should not talk. So with due respect, Your Honor, I prefer I don't know. And
well,
so
you don't
it's not an easy area.
Really, your response was probably the effect on the state budget would be relatively minimal. But the effect on county budgets could be a little bit more substantial. If you're going to go from up $10 on every case where the court makes an appointment within the scope of this rule, and the cost is picked up by the counties. Now, when you made your opening statements, you say it's a natural function of the court to decide what reasonable fees are. But I don't recall ever having voted on something that quite so explicitly says, well, counties, you're going to pick up so many millions of extra dollars. I mean, isn't there a distinction there that we have to kind of come to grips with?
Your Honor, it's a distinction that I suspect the court has come to grips in the past because, again, this is what we're asking in the first part of the petition in regard to going from 70 to 80 is something the court has already done. And the court has already sort of faced this issue of being comfortable in saying what is a reasonable fee for purposes of these court appointments. And it did so back in 78 when it first started, when it took it from the legislative rule that existed and then created the Supreme Court rule. I think the Hayes-Brook case does, again, which Frederick references, does a nice job of laying that history out.
I wasn't here when that happened, and I don't believe that anyone else was here except the Chief Justice. I mean, this is a little bit we're kind of dancing around here. And I just want to put it right on the record. The merits of the petition are unassailable. I would be surprised if anyone in the room would say there is no merit to $80 an hour for these kinds of services. And if governments could afford them, they should certainly pay them. And, well, we're very sympathetic. I think what I'm troubled with is the petitioners are not really coming to grips with the hard politics of this. I don't see the next budget session as being an easy one, a place where it is easy to find money, where aid to local governments are going to go up. I think it is entirely possible they may go down, and yet forcing more expenditures seems to me that the timing almost couldn't be worse. And I'm a little troubled by good people making an honorable case, but so out of touch with reality, without coming to grips with any concrete plan of where the money would come from or anything other except you good justices go and do it.
I do respect, and I hope we haven't conveyed otherwise, that this is not an easy answer. It is not an easy position to be in, the position of the court. But in fact, the court does, as part of its responsibilities in constitutional cases, not uncommonly issue orders that have fiscal impact on municipalities. When it tells them to stop doing things or to start hiring people that they discriminatorily were not doing in the past or to provide compensation because of constitutional violations, that has fiscal impact. Why does it do that? Because it's a constitutional imperative. And what we're suggesting, Your Honor, is we do respect, and that's why the proposal here is what we believe to be fairly modest, to go from the 70 to the 80. We respect that it will have some fiscal impact, but we do also believe that it's a constitutional imperative to set this just compensation rate at a rate that the court believes is fair. So please do not take our lack of precision on some questions as some sort of, well, we'll throw it in your hands. That's not the point. We do think that it will have some impact. We are hopeful that, in fact, in the long run, as Justice Ziegler points out, there will be, in fact, a lessening of the burden on the counties. If the legislature listens and participates in the shared role that the Frederick case and this state's constitution envisions. So we are mindful of those issues. But we are also mindful of this court's responsibility, a responsibility that it undertakes, again, not uncommonly, when it faces constitutional wrongdoing at the hands of municipalities.
With all possible respect, it seems to me there is a serious flaw in the argument that it is a constitutional imperative to impose costs on the counties, but no constitutional imperative to impose any extra costs for public defenders on the state.
This court doesn't have the authority, frankly, or at least we're not asking the court to take the authority to change the statute that governs the public defender. There is an argument that might be something that the court could do under 751.12 in a rulemaking. We are not asking that it do that at this point. So what we are asking the court to do is to do what it is clearly empowered to do, and that is to state, as it has done since 1978 and even before that, what fair and appropriate compensation is for folks who are appointed by the court, for that universe of folks identified in 81.02. That is something that the court has done, and we're asking it to do again 15 years after the fact, after the last time it's done so. And we're asking it to do that which it has previously seen it has the authority and power to do, and an appropriate exercise.
Maybe I would like to follow up with Justice Prosser's question. There's something that calls upon the court to act when you speak of constitutional rights, constitutional imperative, constitutional duty, to make sure that the indigent receive competent counsel. The right to counsel includes the right to competent counsel. All of those words are familiar to me, right? So I hear the song that you're singing. But there's another part of your request that causes me to pause, because when you go from 70 to 80 in non-constitutional environment, guardian ad litem, arguably guardianships, you could probably make an argument that they're all constitutional, civil Gideon, you know. So I return, as I live in Wausau, and I regularly speak with our county administrator. And I'm going to say, no, indigent defendants aside, because in sub 3 you're not really asking us to tackle the public defender stuff, indigent defendants aside, I think the attorneys in Marathon County should get a $10 raise. And he'd say to me, well, Ann, you know, that sounds reasonable, but, you know, we're thinking about closing the county-run nursing home. And out in Athens, we might have to cut the breakfast for the kindergarten. So, but I understand, I feel your pain. How do I respond? I mean, and I say that a bit tongue-in-cheek, because the idea in a non-constitutionally mandated environment to give attorneys $10 an hour raise when tough choices have to be made by local government is a difficult choice. But you're advocating that that's what we do. Is that correct?
That's precisely right. And the Frederick case couldn't make clearer, in my view, anyway.
Oh, we have the ability to
not,
do it.
But not just the ability, Your Honor. You have the responsibility. You have the responsibility. It's a shared power with the legislature. How else is the legislature supposed to know what a reasonable fee is? If this court understands what it is but remains silent, then you no longer have a partnership. You no longer have a functioning ability to establish reasonable compensation in this state, because the party with the most at-hand knowledge on what is reasonable and what is fair and what is just compensation, that party to the partnership is keeping that view to itself and isn't saying anything. That leads to dysfunction. And that's not the way that the Constitution envisions this court caretaking the fair administration of justice in the state.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel. We have roughly, or maybe precisely, 11 speakers. We have another hearing. It's 11:25. As is usual here, more time is devoted to the presenters. Questions are asked. Comments are made. And then I say, when each of you comes up, try not to repeat what has been said. You can endorse it. And you might consider answering questions that have been asked that other speakers have not been able to respond to because it's out of their expertise. With those words in mind, I will call our list, and I have on the list James Brennan, Raymond Alsto, Sarah Diedrich, Mark Wadium, John Ebbett, Carlo Escrita, Brian Gleason, John Barrett, John Birdsall, Hank Schultz, and Deb Smith. And if anyone else would like to speak, give your name to the marshal. Mr. Brennan.
If you please, court. My name is James M. Brennan. I'm president-elect of the State Bar of Wisconsin. Jim Bohl, our president-elect, is unable to appear today. He is in trial. I'm here today to introduce two members of our Board of Governors who will be presenting on the petitions before the court. On 10-03, this pending petition, Attorney Ray DeLasto, will be arguing the bar's position in support of this petition. He's an attorney practicing with Gimbel, Riley, Guerin, and Brown in Milwaukee. He's a well-known litigator on the criminal side and civil rights of his client community. Before going into private practice, Ray served as first assistant public defender, Milwaukee's public defender office from 89 through 90. Prior to that, he was an assistant state public defender, felony division in Milwaukee, and he was legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union from 78 to 80. He was both a county and state paid defender. Ray will address the history of the transition from court-appointed attorneys in the late 1970s to the sort of shared role that we have now between the courts and the executive branch. On the petition 1004, presenting on behalf of the State Bar in opposition will be Attorney Frank Remington. Frank is a member of the Board of Governors. He really needs little introduction to the court. He's an Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Justice. Prior to joining DOJ, he clerked for the Wisconsin Supreme Court and spent a number of years in private practice. His professional experience includes civil rights, constitutional law, environmental protection, commercial litigation. Currently prosecutes Medicaid fund and health care crimes for DOJ. He's an active member of the State Bar. As I said, he's currently a member of the Board of Governors and is active in bar activities. He will be presenting on petition 1004 in opposition to that. With that introduction, which is about all I'm here to do today, Attorney Ray DeLasto.
Thank you, Mr. Brennan. We appreciate your appearance in order to introduce people from the member of the bar, and you've done it for both, so you're off the hook.
Great.
Thank you. Do you have anything else you want to say specifically about either one of these? Or are you leaving it to?
Well, other than saying that I strongly support the petition before the court. This is lawyers getting paid to represent poor people has been a difficult call for as long as they've been a lawyer. It's been a fundamental activity of judges across the state, and to some extent it's become a lost art among the judiciary, the appointment of counsel and the compensation of counsel. This petition before the court really allows you to consider whether, you know, that role, that fundamental judicial role, should be, you know, reasserted. And it's certainly my hope that you do that.
Thank you. Mr. Dahlstrom, and you will keep in mind, of course, time frame, please.
Yes, if my reputation precedes me. good morning, Justices, and may it please the Court. Again, I'm here to briefly, and I will try to do it briefly, outline the perspective of the State Bar, which is in firm support of the proposed order in Petition 1003 that you're considering. At its meeting in May 2010, the Board of Governors voted unanimously with two abstentions to support the petition you have before you. And in taking this position, the Governors acted on the recommendations of the Boards of the Elder Law, Family Law, Children and Law Sections, the Government Lawyers Division, and Senior Lawyers Division. Much of the Board of Governors' discussion that led to this support focused on the statutory rate for public defender appointments, which I won't repeat here. It's sort of like Bill Murray and Groundhog Day. It keeps back to the same early 70s rates. It hasn't changed, or early 80s rates. The State Bar has promoted a higher statutory rate for public defender appointed counsel for nearly two decades and has argued that the rates of compensation should be equal to those set by this court for court-appointed attorneys. And I think that strong statement and guide and goal is important and can be something this court does set out in an order rather than something that's a little less direct as a commentary or a footnote. The Bar has actively supported legislation to accomplish this, most recently 2009 Assembly Bill 224, which would have raised the rate for State Bar or for public defender appointed counsel to $70 per hour. Unfortunately, that bill was never even scheduled for a floor vote and got nowhere. While the petition before this Honorable Court today would not directly set that rate, it does stipulate, as has been the subject of some discussion, that the $80 per hour rate and anything less than that would be deemed unreasonable. And I think deemed unreasonable for purposes of affording competent appointed counsel for the defense of indigent criminal defendants. And this certainly reflects the Board of Governors' view that the current rate of $40 per hour falls far short by any measure of recognizing both the critical role that the public defender appointed counsel play in our constitutional system and the economic realities that many, if not all, of these lawyers face. By comparison, the state currently pays video editors $225 an hour for services, photographers up to $200 an hour, occupational and safety consultants $145 per hour. While other presenters have dealt with this, I want to bring the perspective of the Wisconsin lawyer that the Bar represents. The Wisconsin lawyer typically is a small business owner. In fact, of the approximately 3,800 law firms in Wisconsin, 9 out of 10 are small businesses with 5 or few lawyers. And then you have the concomitant staff of secretaries, a paralegal, other assistants who all have families. Fully 7 out of 10 law firms in the state are solo practices, consisting of only one lawyer, but again with staff. The small businesses these Wisconsin lawyers operate are woven into the fabric of Wisconsin's economic life in communities, rural, small town, midtown, as well as mid-size, as well as big cities. They provide employment, pay taxes, and support other businesses in their communities and around the state, in addition to doing the work of bringing justice for all. Yet the hourly rate for private attorneys who take PD appointments has been frozen at a level that is not sufficient to cover typical overhead expenses, let alone create an incentive for more experienced lawyers to accept PD cases. I wonder how many small businesses in Wisconsin could continue to operate in 2010 at rates based established 15 years ago, which were only $5 more than the rates established some 30 years ago. The Bar recognizes the acute budgetary pressures and difficult policy choices the next legislature and the new governor will have to make. We can't avoid that. It's national. It's endemic. But budgets are ultimately an embodiment of our priorities as a state and society. And we urge, as the State Bar, for lawyers and for the indigent criminal defendants in the state, that this honorable court take a position, a strong position, that sets a guide and a goal for this cooperative effort of the legislature and the governor to deal with in mandating that competent counsel is adequately paid. The State Bar's support for Petition 1003 reflects our strong consensus that the time has come to fully recognize the constitutional rights of Wisconsin citizens facing trial on criminal matters and the economic realities facing the small business operators who defend these rights. The provision of adequate and competent legal representation to indigent criminal defendants truly is, and this is something I've been arguing for 34 years, an essential and critical public service, just as important as fire and police and safe water and other provisions of critical services. And this court, we believe, has to make this statement to the legislature and the governor so that they will take it to heart and something can get done. A strong prod. Now to answer a couple of the questions before I will take any new ones that the court has put out from various justices. Justice Rogensack asked about the rates of pay for other states and Exhibit C. Again,
The rates of pay wasn't a concern to me.
And who paid?
It was who pays.
Right.
Right. And do they, any of the states share, like perhaps the county and the courts would share, or perhaps the state and the courts would share? That's what I was saying.
And when I started as a public defender in Racine County, was county funded. This is before the statewide system. The county paid. We had to go in before the county board along with the assistant DAs and argue for a small rate increase or argue for our salary. And there are certain problems with not only conflicts, but I can tell you point blank, a case arose in which was a highly celebrated case. And I can still remember a county member of the county board coming by one evening saying, "Your guys' budget is coming up. You better do the right thing." It was the intent of the legislature to have a statewide system of appointed counsel, which in 1978 and thereafter took that away from that local political pressure, so you would now have an agency funded statewide. You would not have these problems of potential conflict.
At that time, I believe that the judges, the local judges, appointed counsel.
In some counties, in Milwaukee County, and Legal Aid Society did the PD work. I left Racine and was a legal aid lawyer out of the juvenile division. So larger counties decided they could contract. Some did it with legal aid. Most counties, it was court appointed, as Chief Justice Abrahamson said. But
and
county paid for it.
The issue came up on county appointments, not only for criminal defense, but whether or not the judges were being even-handed in appointments?
Absolutely. You had situations, and before legal aid took over in Milwaukee County, a short list, and who would get on that? Would it be only certain friends of certain judges? Would it be certain people who might be have a few less teeth in the mouth as far as the ability to really vigorously defend the case? In other situations, there was allegations of favoritism. So all of these issues the legislature decided, as well as an overarching concern of taking off the county taxpayer and the tax rolls the cost of providing indigent defense. I wrote an article in the county magazines for the state, county association, about 6-7 years ago outlining this history, and that's important.
And according to these statute books, the present existence of the state public defender dates back to 1977, which matches what you just said. Is that
yes,
your
Your Honor.
Understanding?
They enacted it as the state. There'd be 1977 laws, but it became in effect in 78, and then they hired, and this was changing it from just an appellate counsel, mm-hmm. which was the original court appointed, to all trial counsel as well. And from then on, it became all appointed no longer by courts for most state public defender appointees. But this would be, as far as the funding, it was always a mix, but that mix has tipped, Justice Rogensack, now till we have some almost $6 million being funded by court appointments for local county.
$5 to $6 million is what you think the counties are putting in.
That's what we have noted in our petition.
Well, I saw it somewhere. Go ahead.
And Milwaukee County says they ponied up $4.5 million just for Milwaukee County. So the difference is what the whole rest of the state.
And that's a figure from our petition, and I don't know what year that was.
Okay.
But I can tell you, as Justice Ziegler has pointed out, when the state public defender's indigency requirements, you almost had to be super indigent or three times indigent, that added to this pressure to have the counties appointed. And they,
when the court appoints an attorney now under Supreme Court rule, the fee is $70 an hour to the attorney, but the counties pay that, and they also have to pay all the costs, don't they, if there are deposition costs or anything like that? Isn't that in addition to that?
They would have to pay costs. Typically, if it's in a criminal case, we would ask in a county appointed. If you're going to hire a psychiatrist or if you're going to try to get a forensic expert, you would ask the court to do that. But the county ultimately picks it up.
In Milwaukee,
it's Department of Administration. You submit your bill and you get paid.
Okay. Thank you.
The real issue is whether or not they're deemed indigent by the court. Sometimes courts set payment plans or reimbursement rates or wage assignments or different things, and it's very reasonable for the person to pay something, $5 a month or something. So it's not always these. Just because there's an appointment doesn't mean 100% of the time the county is always going to pay 100% of that bill.
That's correct. That is correct. But I think it's critical, as the first public defender, Mr. Freebert, mentioned earlier, that this court make a solid statement on this that is going to have some impact to influence legislators. The dialogue has to begin. We're in tough times. There's no question about that. Money is always short, and sadly, the clientele that the lawyers who represent indigent criminal defendants really have no political voice. They have no weight out there. So it's up to us in the best traditions of this state and this honorable history of this court, as well as the U.S. Supreme Court's admonition in Gideon, to come out and make this strong statement. Otherwise, it'd be as if the Supreme Court had said in Gideon, well, indigents have the constitutional right to a competent appointed defense, but if you want to pay for it, but you don't really have to. Well, they do have to do that. And I'm not wanting to set up, and the bar is not suggesting that this court mandate and have a date set when everything has to be paid $80 an hour across that board. But at the same time, it will make the legislature and executive know that this is the rate. Anything less is unreasonable. And in arguing for the public defender, when they go back in the legislative session in 2011, some kind of movement may occur. Absent this, I don't see it happening. Any other questions?
Thank you, Counsel.
Very much for your time today.
Sarah Diedrich, Senior Legislative Associate, Wisconsin Counties Association. Ms. Diedrich.
Thank you, Honorable Chief Justice and Honorable Members of the Court. My name is Sarah Diedrich Kasdorf. I am the Senior Legislative Associate for the Wisconsin Counties Association, and I am here today to discuss the county's opposition to this particular rule. Simply stated, this petition clearly has financial implications for county government that we simply cannot afford at this time. As you all know, when an individual does not qualify for state public defender representation or is in need of a guardian ad litem or adversary counsel, counsel is appointed at county expense. Now, there have been several questions up to this point asking what specifically is the cost to counties of this petition going to be. So what I'm going to provide for you is my best estimate based on some of the data that we have available to us. In 2008, according to the petition, and I believe this number comes also from a survey done by the State Public Defender's Office, counties spent approximately $6 million on court-appointed counsel for indigent defendants. And in 2008, based upon the reports that counties are required to submit each year to the court for their October 1 report, in 2008, we reported spending about $11 million on guardian ad litem services.
Now, wait a minute. On your $6 million, is that just for criminal defendants?
Just criminal defendants,
okay.
Correct.
That's very important then, that.
Yes.
And the $11 million, you say, is from GALs,
yes,
which have been required since statehood. Lawyers have been required. Yeah, and that, you want to re-explain to the court about where you got the figures and what the audited statements are, if you would, because this has been a major issue that no one really knows how much the counties spend because they all have different kinds of budget papers and there's no uniformity. But you can explain the county, the court set up with a lot of help from the counties, a uniform accounting system, and you provide your statements now of costs or expenditures for the court on the uniform one, and you are being audited.
That is correct. And we as the Counties Association did support the creation of the Uniform Chart of Accounts, as well as we supported and continue to support the court's budget request to continue with the auditor position, because it is important for us as we go to the legislature time and again and discuss with them the financial impacts of their decisions on counties with respect to the court system. You know, we find it would be much easier if we had credible numbers that we could use. The best numbers we have available to us right now is that October 1 report, so those are the numbers we're using here. But we do understand that, you know, counties report court costs in many different ways. You know, we report costs to the Department of Revenue in one manner. We report costs to the to the court system in another manner. And so based upon the best numbers that we do have available, this is what we had to use for our estimate. And again, we do hope that in the future, with the counties continuing to partner with the court to come up with numbers that are uniform across the counties, that then we can come to the legislature and use those numbers with confidence. But again, given what we have available to us, this is the best we could use at this time.
You have available to you a county-by-county breakdown. So you're talking about $17 million spent in 2008. Do you have a county-by-county breakdown?
That we could get to you. I know the guardian ad litem numbers are reported in the October 1 report on a county-by-county basis, and we do, and so those numbers are readily available. I can certainly contact, and I believe I have in my office as well, the Public Defender Survey that does have the numbers on a county-by-county basis.
There are other county-appointed attorneys, such as in TPR cases, you may be appointing counsel.
Right, and those are numbers I would have to survey the counties in order to obtain.
For those who in the audience who aren't familiar with these accounting issues, the court's budget, as you know, Ms. Diedrich, includes continuing the auditor as a continuous employee of the court, and that the County Association is supporting that, and we are too, just because before this we did not have numbers that could be trusted because everybody kept them differently.
That is absolutely correct.
Your estimate just on these is...
My estimate based just solely on these numbers that we do have available to us, utilizing a 14% increase, which is the increase from the 70 to 80, would give us a $2.4 million figure annually. And again, that is just only on those two case types.
And of course, it wouldn't affect private bar for public defenders. It only affect court-appointed.
This is just the county-appointed counsel.
The guardian ad litem number, are these only indigent appointments, or are these all guardian ad litem appointments? Because guardians ad litem, there's a difference, right?
Yeah.
Because oftentimes at the conclusion of a case, the court will order that the parties reimburse the county for the guardian ad litem expense. Sometimes they split it, sometimes they don't. So I'm trying to figure out, is this the outlay after any reimbursement? Is this just the number the counties have to eat? Tell me what that number is.
This is the number that the counties report as their outlay of expense for the October 1 report, which is the $11 million. Now, there's another section of that report as well, where counties do report the amount that they do recoup on an annual basis. But it's important to point out as well that the year in which you recoup is not necessarily the year in which you incur the expenses either.
That's true. So does this include under that theory, you'd never really have the offset because or you may not be paid in the exact same year, and that wouldn't be uncommon. But does this $11 million number reflect any offset for amounts that the county is reimbursed?
The $11 million does not.
Okay. That's what I thought you were saying.
Within this same year, we recouped about $3 million, just over $3 million in 2008.
The other thing is you do get money from the state on a court support.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually the next point I was going to
address. Okay, go ahead. Because that recoups some of this, not all of it, but you get some of it back from the state.
Correct. The next point I was going to bring up were the two programs that were created in the 93-95 state biennial budget. There was the court support services payment program, and there's specifically the guardian ad litem payment program. And that's the program that I really wanted to focus on today. The program was started again in the 93-95 state biennial budget, and annual reimbursement under the program is $4,738,000 when the program was created, and that amount has not been increased since the program was created back in the 93-95 state budget. This funding amount, this $4.7 million, was also permanently reduced by 1% during the last state budget deliberations as well. And there is no similar program to reimburse counties for our indigent defense costs as there is for the guardian ad litem cost as well.
That's annual?
It's annual. It's just under just over $4.7 million. We took a small decrease during the last budget. And again,
the recoupment that Justice Siegler asked about is in addition to that?
It would be in addition to that. It's a separate program.
The recoupment comes from the individuals who got the guardian ad litem service.
Yes.
This 4.7 comes from the state GPR.
It's state GPR, which is generated from the court support services surcharge, which use of those surcharge dollars we could have a very lengthy discussion on.
Is there some recoupment as well on dean appointments?
There is some recoupment on dean appointments as well. I do not have those figures. And again, as the costs tend to increase, our ability to recoup decreases as well. And our clerks of court have referenced that time and again when we look at the increases in, surcharge and other fees that are added to court costs. We see as those fees go up, we tend to see a decrease. So again, one of our concerns is as we can increase the $70 to $80 rate, what impact it may have on our ability to recoup our cost.
Is there information with regard to the $11 million that would inform the reader how much of the $11 million is paid pursuant to what I will call a 1M contract as opposed to an hourly rate? By that, I mean there are counties that contract under a 1M for flat fees with law firms, which presumably are less than the $70 per hour rate. Is the $11 million figure nuanced in that fashion at all as to which comes under 1M and which doesn't?
The reporting requirements do not specify whether or not it was paid at the $70 an hour rate or whether or not it was at a contracted rate.
And you know, of course, Ms. Diedrich, but just so the audience sitting here knows, the court has in 2-3 budgets requested increased sums be paid to the county to cover much of these costs.
Yes,
and they have not passed.
Absolutely, and we as the association appreciate the work of the court in recognizing the cost associated with court operations that have been placed on us by the state legislature. And again, the recent biennial budget request was the third in a row where the court has requested combining our two court support programs into one and allocating a percentage of the court support services surcharge to us.
In devising this budget, as in the two prior ones, we have worked with the county association and therefore the county boards to make it realistic and provide funding needed to cover what are viewed as core court programs under PPAC's statements in their funding report.
Right. And our membership really appreciates the partnership that we have with the courts with regard to the state funding allocated for the court system. And we hope to maintain that partnership with the courts into the future as well. We value that partnership, and again, we do appreciate the support on the funding issues.
As you know, the court is delighted to partner, converse, and when we disagree, we'll also have that, but it will not affect the partnership.
Yes, thank you. While the current rule does allow for contracting for the provision of legal services at a rate less than the stated hourly rate, many of the contracts that are entered into by the counties are also based on a percentage of the hourly rate. So although the ability to contract is there, once that hourly rate goes up, we do anticipate that the contracted rates will go up as well. Justice Prosser did make reference to the political reality that this petition does fall under, and we believe that the timing of this position really could not be worse for county government. Our counties provide a vast array of services to the citizens of our state. In these tough economic times, the demand for our services has significantly increased, especially in our county health and human services departments. For example, yesterday for another project, I just looked up the increase in our food share or food stamp caseload in the state of Wisconsin over the past 5 years. And those numbers show that the number of individuals receiving food share has more than doubled in the last 5 years. And that is just one area where the county, where the pressure is really being placed on the counties to provide a valuable service to the citizens of our state, yet at the same time, we received decreased funding from the state in the last budget to provide that very service. The other point I want to mention with regard to the state legislature and funding is that the state legislature has imposed two separate yet distinct limits on the ability of counties to raise funds to provide services to our state's most vulnerable populations. The first limit was enacted during the 93-95 state biennial budget, and that limit caps the property tax rates at our December 1992 levels. The second limit caps the amount a county may levy to no greater than an amount equal to the prior year's levy plus 3% or the growth in a county's equalized value due to new construction, whichever is greater. And if you look at the equalized value numbers that were released in August of this year, all but 9 counties had a decrease in their 2010 equalized values. And I want to reference this point because we had one county this year that actually ran up against the tax rate limit, and that county was Columbia County. So Columbia County was unable to take advantage of the 3% levy that is allowed under the levy limit program and instead had to cut their budget. Columbia County has provided me with a whole list of position reductions that they had to undertake in order to make their budget balance. And it affected every area of the county budget, including the court system. For example, Columbia County decreased by 30 hours per week the number of hours that their judicial assistants would be working. And the county also is cutting a deputy clerk of circuit court. So the pressures on counties are real. The pressures are great. And while the tax rate limit this year did only affect Columbia County, we have a whole list of counties that we believe will be affected in the next, for our 2012 budgets, if we are unable to successfully request that the legislature repeal that tax rate limit. So we are going to be in a world of hurt as counties in 2012. If we thought 2010 and 2011 budgets were bad, 2012 is going to be significantly worse if counties are going to be coming up against that tax rate limit. Now, in addition to the limits and our ability to raise revenue, counties also received significant funding cuts during the 2009-2011 state biennial budget deliberations. As was applied to the courts, 1% cuts were applied to most of our state appropriations. We also had many other programs that received decreases of in excess of 1%. Examples of one of those programs in particular was the Children and Families BCA, or Basic County Allocation, which are the dollars that counties use to provide child welfare services. We do child abuse and neglect investigations with those dollars. We pay for foster care with those dollars. And so, again, the pressures on our counties are great to try to balance the aid that we receive balance the amount of property tax revenue we bring in and still somehow try to, you know, comply with all of the state-mandated programs. Now, our counties are in the process, many of them this week, some have already done so. We're working on adopting our budgets for 2011, and many of our county budgets do contain cuts in services, including many employee layoffs. As difficult as our county 2011 budgets are, we're already predicting a budget year like no other for 2012. There is no room in our budgets at this point for mid-year budget adjustments. So if this court were to make any changes to the rule and increase that rate from $70 to $80, we do respectfully request that those changes take place no sooner than January 1 of 2012 so that we would be able to, you know, budget for those increased costs. It was one of our counties indicated to me when I met with them a week or so ago. They said that they pulled the last rabbit out of the hat. They have done every possible thing that they can to refinance debt and do everything they can to try to come up with the revenue needed to balance their budgets. So at this point, anything that would come, any increased cost that would come to us mid-year would pose counties, we'd be in some budgetary crisis. The situation facing the state of Wisconsin as the 2011-2013 budget process begins is bleak. The state budget deficit amounts are estimated right now at over $3 billion, and the road to balancing the state next state budget will be very long. If the last state budget provides any insight into the coming budget process, counties can anticipate additional cuts in state aid with no decrease in service expectations. In addition, the state legislature did modify the standards utilized to determine eligibility for state public defender services during 2010 with an effective date of July 1 of 2011. The funding for this change has yet to be allocated. With a $3 billion budget deficit on the horizon, funding for this change, we believe, is in jeopardy, let alone identifying a funding source to double the rates paid to private bar attorneys accepting SPD appointments. It is really clear from our reading of the petition that the petitioner's focus is on the rates paid by the state public defender to private bar attorneys that accept SPD appointments. No reference is made in the petition to any other case types. However, as this court has pointed out, this petition does affect all cases in which an attorney is appointed by the court. Now, we as counties understand that there is clearly a difference in the rates that were set for payment to private attorneys accepting SPD cases by Supreme Court rule and Wisconsin state statute. Increasing the rate in 8102, we believe, will not settle that dispute. The discrepancy existed in 1994 when the rate was increased from $60 to $70 an hour, and I actually believe I testified in opposition to that petition as well, and the discrepancy will exist again today regardless of the court's ruling on the petition. You know, just from our perspective, if this were a legislative proceeding that had funding attached, our position may very well be different than what it is today. The one thing we do know for certain...
Our budget passes as proposed, with the county getting much more money. Will your position be different?
I would have to take that back to our board of directors. But again, I think we would look at that, we'd look at it a little more carefully. But the one thing we do know for certain right now is that if this petition is adopted, the cost to counties for court-appointed counsel, whether they're indigent defense cases, GAL cases, will increase, and counties just do not have the means to provide an increase at this time, and we therefore respectfully request that you deny this petition.
Thank you, Ms. Giedrich. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Wadigam? Lobbyist out of Gamey County.
I want to get you
and Mr. Ebbett in before we break for lunch at 12:15 when I have a legislative committee meeting. So if we can do that, I'd appreciate that, because much of what you may have said has been said by Ms. Deacon.
Yes, Sarah has covered everything from a county perspective very well. I was just going to add a couple things pertaining directly to out of Gamey County. Sarah mentioned the 1993 levy rate law and where counties are on that list. We are number 11 on that list, so that level of budget pressure that Columbia is currently going through is probably 2 years away for us. So we're in a very awkward spot. My county is putting in about $421,225 of property tax levy dollars, into this year's budget, which was adopted a week ago. There isn't the circuit court for the
all costs for all attorneys.
For yes, and that includes the GAL, the adversarial counsel for mental health placements, for Watts reviews, and indigent appointed counsel.
Criminal defendant.
Yes.
I'm going to have to say if you can't wind up quickly because Justice Robinczak has to leave for lunch at noon.
I have a meeting at noon.
Okay.
So we would just ask that that you would kindly leave this into the hands
and
of...
And $425,000 gross or net. You'll get net. You may net some of that back, I assume.
Well, we can try to collect, and in many cases, you know, we do, but it tends to be a delayed, and, you know, we have millions of dollars of money owed to the county on the books.
I understand.
Collecting is very difficult, and it's only gotten worse.
But this is after you're going to get payment by the state?
Yes, that's...
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's net in that sense?
Yes, ma'am. Yes. And just one other thing that didn't come up, the request for indexing. Justice Prosser mentioned the political realities, and we would suggest that the last item that the state had that was indexed, the gas tax, that was removed by the legislature. So we would also be opposed to the indexing provision of the rate from. But I guess just – and then you also mentioned one other thing. You talked about your concerns of the way the sub-3 is drafted, and we would also share those concerns. And at a minimum, we would hope that would be changed. But just to keep it brief, we would request the court deny the petition at this time.
In toto. All of it. Mm-hmm.
All of it.
We appreciate your coming twice, and appreciate that you cut it short so that you didn't repeat Ms. Diedrich, and in light of the court's needs.
Thank you.
We appreciate that. Thank you. We'll pick this up again. Is 1 o'clock okay, or do you need more time?
I can be back at 1:15.
Okay. Anybody, 1:15 okay for everybody? Hearing no objection, we'll come back at 1:15, and John Ebbett is up. Is anyone not going to be back in the afternoon that is still slated to speak? Okay. You still have a long list to go. All right.